This lecture, entitled Stop Worrying and Start Living, is dedicated to the merit and honor of the Hillman family.
Good evening. My name is Gary Faitler. On behalf of the Jewish Renaissance Project, I'd like to thank all of you for coming this evening. It is truly a rare honor for me to be able to introduce Rabbi Shmuel Irons, Dean of the Detroit Kollel. Rather than merely detailing a somewhat typical overview of Rabbi Irons' impressive personal biography, I'd like to provide a little deeper context of who Rabbi Irons is and what you will be hearing in this lecture series, Joy and Self-Fulfillment Through Jewish Wisdom. Many of you may be aware that there's a custom this time of year to study Pirkei Avot, the Ethics of the Fathers, on Shabbat. This particular tractate of the Talmud provides a series of statements by our sages expressing their ethical and philosophical teachings. The tractate begins with an introduction describing the historic transmission of Torah wisdom. It says, Moshe, Moses, received the Torah from Sinai and transmitted it to Joshua. Joshua to the elders to the prophets to the men of the great assembly. The account of Pirkei Avot ends at this point, contemporary with their time. I'd like to continue, if I may, the recounting of the Torah transmission that followed from then. The men of the great assembly transmitted it to the sages of the Talmud, the sages of the Talmud to the Gaonim, the scholars of Babylon, the Gaonim to the Rishonim, the scholars of Western Europe, including Maimonides and Rashi, and the Rishonim to the Acharonim, the later scholars of Europe, including the Maharal of Prague and the Vilna Gaon. And they transmitted the tradition from their teacher to student up until the 20th century. In the early 20th century, in this tumultuous period, a handful of great recipients of this tradition made their way to America and established the premier Torah institutions that we are blessed with here today. Prominent among them was Rabbi Yaakov Yitzhak Ruderman, who founded Neir Yisrael in Baltimore, and Aaron Cutler, who founded Beis Medrash Gvoah in Lakewood, New Jersey. I mention these two institutions in particular not only because of their prominence, but because these were the yeshivas in which Rabbi Irons studied and joined a somewhat larger handful of scholars here in America who are now passing the tradition on to the next generation. The issues that Rabbi Irons will be addressing in the series are clearly timely and contemporary, but the wisdom with which they will be explored is timeless. At this time, I'd like to introduce Rabbi Shmuel Irons.
First of all, good evening. It comes in many forms, has many names. Fear, worry, anxiety. But its effect is all the same. It steals the joy from life, prevents a person from reaching his or her potential, and it can often totally paralyze a person, forcing the person to live a life of inaction and frustration. These fears and worries know no boundaries and respect no individual. It touches people from all walks of life, irrespective of status or intelligence. In fact, some of the world's most famous and brilliant people were constantly plagued by fears and worries that wreaked havoc on their lives. The pity of all of this is that in most cases, it could be easily prevented or cured. Is the consensus of the mental health community that for the most part, worries and anxieties are based on erroneous suppositions and attitudes and compounded by a fertile imagination that makes even a remote possibility of the feared event a probability, and every probability a virtual certainty. In the words of the noted psychiatrist and pioneer in psychotherapy, Dr. William James, I quote, "The greatest discovery of all times is that man can alter his life by altering his attitude of mind," end quote. In this lecture, we will share with you an attitude of mind based on thousands of years of Jewish experience and learning. Alone or in conjunction with other forms of therapy, this attitude will greatly help you to conquer your worries and fears and substitute them with hope and confidence. Not only will you experience relief, but you also begin to experience the pleasure that comes from having a spiritual outlook on life. Before we explore the Jewish approach to worry and fear, I'd like to talk a little about the different kinds of things we worry about and review some of the most common ways that therapists deal with worry. Worry can be roughly classified into two kinds. One, which we will call rational worry, is the kind you may experience while you're walking alone in the middle of the night in a high-crime, drug-infested area. It is similar to the fear that a soldier may experience when he receives the order, fix bayonets and charge. Not only is worry an appropriate feeling in that kind of situation, but by making the person more sensitive to the dangers all around, those feelings may very well save his life. There's a second kind, however, which we will call irrational worry. For instance, one scenario is that you have an important appointment tomorrow. You're being interviewed for a new position. The night before, you can't sleep. You keep on thinking, what happens if I'm rejected? What happens if I make a fool of myself at the interview? It's no use. I'm probably going to fail this interview like I failed all the rest. You may become so distraught that you cancel the interview. Rationalizing wouldn't have worked out anyway. Another scenario is that you're in an elevator. As the elevator rises higher and higher, you're gripped with the fear that the elevator cables may snap, hurtling you to a horrible death. You break out in a cold sweat, feel nauseous, and barely are able to make it to your destination. Both these scenarios, the job interview and the elevator, we would call irrational worries. That means the most rational people would not experience a deep sense of worry in those situations. Concern, perhaps, but not real fear or anxiety. How do you deal with a rational worry? There are actually three basic approaches to alleviate worry, fear, or anxiety. They are best classified as 1, therapy that focuses on the past and the memories that are buried in the subconscious or unconscious mind. 2, therapy that focuses on the present and changing one's present behavior. And 3, therapy that focuses on the future by radically changing one's outlook on life. Probably the most well-known of the three methods is the therapy that focuses on the past. This is a psychoanalytical method that was first developed by Sigmund Freud and his disciples and subsequently borrowed and modified by others. Since so many avail themselves of this method, I would like to go into a little detail of its history and methodologies that you can judge for yourself that perhaps this is the method for you. Towards the end of the 19th century, Sigmund Freud's mentor and early associate in Vienna, Dr. Joseph Breuer, discovered that when people unburden themselves to a therapist and reveal their fears and the underlying problems and events that created them, they experience what is known as catharsis, a cleansing or a sense of relief. The theory behind this is that once the unconscious mind is no longer burdened, and those deep-seated fears and repressed memories are brought out in the open, they will automatically dissipate on their own. Freud and his followers expanded Dr. Breuer's basic idea by claiming that virtually all irrational fears are a result of forgotten conflicts and fantasies that a person experienced in childhood and presently reside in the unconscious mind. And unless these forgotten fears are brought out into the open, the person is often doomed to experience one form of fear or another. The nature of these unconscious fears and how they manifest themselves in regular life is, of course, a matter of disagreement amongst the various schools of psychotherapy. In the interest of clarity, permit me to give one small example. 100 years ago, in 1909, Freud made a case study of a 5-year-old boy named Hans, who refused to go out into the street for fear that a horse might bite him. Freud felt that behind that fear was Hans's unconscious fear that his father would punish him, but instead of manifesting this fear toward his father, Hans had subconsciously transferred this fear of his father towards the horse. By displacing his fear and anxiety from his father to the horse, Hans had avoided the object of his phobia and was able to love his father instead of fearing him. In psychoanalytical therapy, the therapist would use free association and dream interpretation to work through Hans's underlying Oedipus complex. According to this theory, as soon as Hans would recognize and resolve the underlying conflict with his father, then the substitute phobia, in this case the fear of horses, would automatically disappear. Of course, all of this is very speculative, and achieving a cure is easier said than done. The Freudian theory is very controversial. Several of Freud's original followers, although in agreement on many of the basic tenets of the importance of discovering one's past and the resulting catharsis, vehemently disagreed with Freud. A psychotherapist trained in one of the other clinical schools of psychotherapy would probably suggest that Hans must have been traumatized in an early age by actually seeing a horse biting someone, or at least some similar experience. Accordingly, it was that experience and not his unresolved conflicts that was the basis of little Hans's fear. In summation, a therapist following this first approach will attempt to discover the root causes of his or her patient's anxieties and bring it out in the open for the patient to see, hoping that the patient will thereby reach a state of catharsis and remain free of those anxieties. In opposition to that approach, there's what is known as the behavior school of psychotherapy, which propounds that what we would call, quote-unquote, the therapy of the present. This school does not dwell upon the root causes that created the fears and anxieties. The focus of that school is on the here and now. The story of the behavior school begins with Ivan Pavlov. I don't know if that name rings a bell. Who, in the process of doing research on the digestive system, discovered what became to be known as the quote-unquote conditioned reflex. For his research on digestion, for which he eventually received the Nobel Prize in 1904, Pavlov needed to collect saliva from his laboratory animals, which in his case were dogs. He did this by placing meat powder in the dogs' mouths. He discovered that as soon as his dogs would see him, even before they smelled the meat powder, they would also salivate. He then tried this with ringing a bell whenever he gave them meat powder. Soon they would salivate at the mere ringing of the bell. The secondary reflex, salivating at the ringing of the bell, is called the conditioned reflex. In America, in 1920, John B. Watson extended Pavlov's animal research into the study of human behavior. He took an 11-year-old boy by the name of Albert, who at the time was not afraid of white laboratory rats. He was frightened, though, of loud, sudden noises. Whenever Watson showed the rat to Albert, he also made this loud, frightening noise. After a while, the mere sight of the rat, even without the loud sound, frightened him. In fact, he became frightened of any furry object, a rabbit, a fur coat, a dog, even a mask of Santa Claus with a long white beard. It's a good thing Albert's not here now. In other words, Watson had succeeded in proving that humans act like Pavlov's dogs. 4 years later, the psychologist Mary Cover Jones showed that conditioning can also be used to remove fears. Peter, a child of almost 3, feared rabbits. While looking at the rabbit in the cage and at a distance, Peter was given candy. Here, the feared rabbit was paired with the pleasure of the candy. Within 6 weeks, Peter was gleefully playing with the rabbit. In other words, fears can be learned and fears can be unlearned. This is the basis of the behavior school of psychotherapy. Based on this principle and methods first discovered by Dr. Andrew Salter in the 1940s, Dr. Joseph Walpe, during the 1950s, developed and tested the methods that now have become standard in the field. Not attempting to reason you out of your fear, provide you with insights, or uncover deep, unconscious conflicts, he developed a straightforward training procedure to respond, like little Peter, to situations that may have paralyzed you for years. In the case of a person who freezes before tests, for instance, the therapist using this method would gradually desensitize the person and condition him, like little Peter, to stop having these fears. I just know of another situation in real life. My son David, some years ago, was a student in the Telz Yeshiva in Chicago. And there was a certain young man who was in his class who came from Los Angeles, who had this fear of flying. So he'd always come by train all the way from Los Angeles to Chicago. Following this, actually, he attended a school that had a mock airplane. And he would sit in and he'd go session after session. He flies airplanes now. As he flies. Yet time doesn't allow me to go into greater detail into this method, but there are many good books that have been written on the subject. The difference between these two schools of thought, the one that probes the past and the one that focuses on the present, is richly illustrated by the following story. A man came to a psychotherapist, and he complained to him that he can't sleep at night. I mean, the man was a wreck. He hadn't slept in weeks. And he has to explain, what's the problem? You know, when I lie down in bed, I have this feeling that somebody's under my bed. So what do you do? Well, immediately I go on the floor to see if somebody's under the bed. No. No one's under the bed, but I figure, you know, by the time I went down, he must have come up on top of the bed. So what do? So I go on top of the bed. Did you see? No. But maybe he went below the bed. Below the bed, above the bed, up the bed, up on top of the bed, below the bed. The whole night, I just go up and down. I can't sleep. It's going on for weeks, Doc. So the therapist nods sympathy. He says, it's a difficult case, but I think we can do this. If you come to me 3 times a week for a year, I think we can cure you. How much will it cost? About $150 a session. I'll think about it. Needless to say, he didn't come back. 3 weeks later, the therapist finds this person. They bump into each other in the street. And he asks him, you know, what happened to you? You know, I haven't seen you. Didn't come back. You know, as soon as I left your office, doctor, I went to the bar, took a drink, and told my problem over to a bartender. He gave me advice, and I'm cured. So what did he do? He told me, go to the hardware store for $10, buy a saw. That's what I did. I came home, I sawed all the legs of my bed. No one could fit under my bed anymore, and I sleep like a baby. That's the difference between the two schools of thought. There's another method, however, that focuses not on unraveling the past nor reconditioning you in the present, but rather concentrates on fostering a positive view of life to deal with the future. In conjunction with other methods or by itself, it offers a different and positive view of reality to help one cope with fears and relieve anxiety. To a great degree, it's far superior to the other methods, in that the other methods deal solely with irrational and pathological fears and anxieties, phobias, and conflicts. There exists, however, a whole world of rational fears, fears that are shared by every rational human being to some degree, the fear of death, or I'll eventually die, the fear of ill health or failing investments. By the way, for many of us, that fear has already become a reality. The fear of marital difficulties and other disappointments in life. How do you cope with fears that make sense? The answer to that question, the method of relieving anxiety that focuses on the future, is the main subject of this lecture. We've divided this lecture into 9 parts. The first letter of each part, spelling out the acronym, should be on your handout, Have Faith. But before we begin, it's important to emphasize the fact that as in all things in life, you must have a strong desire to make the necessary changes that will bring about a better life and not be tolerant of the status quo of fear and anxiety. By the way, generally this comes easy to Jews who by nature are not satisfied with the status quo. I'd like to illustrate this with a story that I once heard from Lord Emanuel Jacobovitz of a blessed memory, the former chief rabbi of the British Empire. And he told me of the story of three people who had a common disease that were diagnosed by a certain specialist that each one of them would only live for 3 months. This story was leaked to the press, and the media decided to do an in-depth, you know, a human interest story about these three people. Three people, imagine, 3 months to live. What are they going to do? According to this story, one was a Frenchman, one was a Scotsman, and one was a Jew. So the reporter interviewed the first interview of the Frenchman and asked him, you know, what are his plans? Does he only have 3 months? It's going to be a very busy 3 months for me. So what are you planning? You know, really, as a Frenchman, I've always was very straight-laced. But now I have 3 months to live. Might as well live life to its fullest. It's going to be a busy 3 months. And then the reporter interviewed the Scotsman and asked him, says, what his plans are. He says, you know, it's going to be a very, very busy 3 months. You know, I was always scrimping and saving for retirement. I only have 3 months. I'm going to take all my money and really enjoy myself. And then the reporter interviewed the Jew and asked him what his plans are. He says, it's going to be a very busy 3 months for me. Really, what are you going to do? I'm looking for another doctor. Before we begin the study of how to rid ourselves of fear and worry, it would seem worthwhile to keep in mind the words of Franklin Delano Roosevelt in his first inaugural address, and I quote, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself, nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed effort to convert retreat into advance," end quote. And I'd like to begin now the first section of Have Faith. The H stands for hope. Although Judaism is multifaceted, if we could find one word to encapsulate the essence of Judaism, perhaps the proper word would be hope. The Talmud teaches us, there's a Gemara in Makos, in Chavdalot Amud Aleph, in 24a, that even though there are 613 mitzvahs, commandments, through the generations, the prophets concentrated on a much smaller group. It explains that King David concentrated on 13, 11, Prophet Isaiah concentrated on 6, 3. And finally, Habakkuk, the prophet of the generation that preceded the destruction of the first temple, summarized what one should concentrate on one thing. Tzadik b'emunoso yichya. The tzadik, the righteous person, lives through his faith, really through his trust in God. And trust, that emotion, that feeling of that you're in good hands, that you're not forlorn, is really something you look around people, it's hard to know, does he really have it or not? Do we have it or not? You know, the Baal Shem Tov, the founder of the Hasidic movement, gave a very interesting analogy. Because imagine, if you'd have someone who is deaf, who sits and he attends a recital of a symphony orchestra, something similar to that. He's sitting there and watching, looking at the crowd, how they're mesmerized, and seeing the various musicians. One is taking something going like this, another musician is going like that. He looks around and says, "Abandon Meshagoyim, they're all crazy." Because if you don't hear the music, you really don't understand. The music of Judaism is really hope. That sense of trust. And we quote from the first on page 2. And you can look on your own, you can look at the various citations. We quote the verse in Psalms, which really summarizes this view. Many are the sorrows of the evil. Baboteich b'Hashem chesed yosef evenu. The person that trusts in God, however, shall be surrounded by kindness. It's really this attitude, this trust, is really one of the pillars, if not the pillar, of what it is to be a religious person, to be a practicing Jew. Western society today, in this society, it's becoming more difficult, of course, to have the same faith, the same trust that our forefathers had. I just briefly, and this is really not the thrust of this lecture, but if one thinks deeply into life, into the role of God in this world, and modern man asks himself very often, where is God? Or is there a God? There are three areas that one has to remind themselves that this world is not self-sustained. It was planned, it was directed by a higher power. That higher power we call Hashem or God. But it's to God that we have faith. The first is the idea of Jewish destiny. There's a beautiful story I once saw. It was in 1966 in Time magazine. They had an editorial about the Jews. And in it, it told the story of Frederick the Great of Prussia. Frederick the Great was a free thinker. He was a son of the Enlightenment. He was one of the patrons of Voltaire. And he challenged the court chaplain, who was a Lutheran minister. And he asked him, "Prove to me that there's a God." And the chaplain answered in two words, "The Jews." The survival of the Jews, this is the end of the 1700s, was much more of a powerful proof of God's existence than all of the proofs that were offered by philosophers. The fact is that we're here. And not only are we here, we're all of the other nations that we've met, that conquered us, that subdued us, we're not here anymore. And we're vibrant. And in fact, miracle of miracles, despite all that we've suffered, and that suffering is predicted in the Torah as well, we've come back to Eretz Yisrael. Almost half of Jewry lives in Israel. And not only is it the national homeland, not only is it a place where any Jew could feel comfortable, but it's now the center of Torah. B'nai Brak and Yerushalayim. Greats, the Torah giants that would have been giants in Europe before, reside in Israel. So it's an amazing, the miracle of just of our survival itself is a major proof, says, of God's existence. Of course, on a different level, of course, what we would call proofs. One is, and I don't know if you've ever read the literature, and if you haven't, it's worthwhile to take the time to go to the library or to the bookstores, is the literature on the near-death experience. In 1974, a small book was published, a thin book, by a minor publishing house. It became an overnight international bestseller. It was called Life After Life. And in it, a physician, Dr. Raymond Moody, described 100 cases of people that were pronounced clinically dead who claimed that their spirit, their consciousness, left their body and witnessed events that happened outside of their body. In half of the instances, they also described going into the other world, experiencing what he calls a being of light, being an angel. Never experienced such love in their life. Many of them, their whole life came back to them in a panorama. Saw their whole life and the mistakes they made in their life. And it's richly detailed. And that book became the beginning of a whole genre of books that were published by cardiologists, by physicians, about what happened to their patients. You know, it's a funny thing. I was once speaking about the subject, and again, this is not the forum for the subject. I was a scholar in residence. I was in Pittsburgh, and I spoke about this. And after the talk, someone came over to me and told me, you know, it happened to me just as you said. And I went into the details how they described it. In fact, today is my Yahrzeit. You know, I died on this day. He was wondering, what should he do? Should he, you know, light a licht? You know, should he have a little candle? What should he do for his Yahrzeit? But it's a relatively common phenomenon. If you read, it's been vastly researched, the near-death phenomenon. There's a whole literature of reincarnation memories. You can't stop but being impressed that there's another world there. And evidently, what seems is that there's an accountability, and everything that we do is recorded. The third area of research, which again, actually I believe that you should take the time to research, is really the miracle of existence through the study of biology, especially cellular biology, and understanding the DNA. It's a miracle. In every cell of your body, something which you can't see, which is only visible really in a human cell through an electronic microscope, there exists, basically, every cell is a whole city. There are some 10,000 chemical reactions that occur in your cell as we're talking. And there's a whole machinery, whole computers of recording and manufacturing. It's happening in every cell of our body. It's very difficult once you study cellular biology to say that it just all happened by itself. But again, this is really something that you owe yourself to read and think. You know, it reminds me, there was a song when I was a little boy that, you know, said that I believe for every drop of rain, says a flower grows. The essence of prayer is an expression of that trust. That's what prayer is. We pray to God. We're basically saying, I know you exist. I know you're listening to me. I'm putting my life into your hands. That's really the essence of hope. So that's the H. The H of have faith is the essence that we're in good hands. It's the essence of hope. There is a God. And he does care about us. But that hope has to be balanced by the next thing, the A of the have faith, which is act. We're placed in this world, and we have to act prudently. I quote here, this is from a Gemara in Gittin 55b in Nehemiah Beis, about that when we act without prudence, without thinking, just as it's possible for a person to commit suicide, a person can do something close to it and act irresponsibly. So this, so one has to balance one's faith with the practicalities of realizing there's God and realizing the opportunities were given to us by God. But we live in this world. We have to go and make a living and take care of our health. So just to illustrate it with a very cute story, there's a story about a little town that was near a major river. We know recently, we know the Mississippi overflooded. And the levees broke, and the town was flooded. They were given little warning. People that could fled to higher ground. And people were taken by surprise. The local authorities sent out boats to pick up those people that were stuck in the home, in the town. There was one particular person, according to this story, who was in his home, and so the water rose, and it rose to the first floor, and he ran up to the second floor, and it rose there, and it rose up into the second floor, and he went up through the crawlway, through the aperture, and he went to the roof, and he was sitting on the roof, and he started praying like he never prayed before in his life. He says, "God, you just have to help me. I'm putting my life into your hands. I know you're there for me." And as he was talking, a rowboat came. And he says, "Come on," he came right over by the roof, "just slide down, I'll take care of you." He says, no, "I know God's going to take care of me." And the rowboat left, and the floodwaters were rising, and finally rose to his chest. And at that point, a large motorboat was coming to pick up the stragglers. And again, he refused the request of the driver. And he says, "I know God's going to take care of me. I'm all set." And later, it rose even higher and was up to his neck. And he was barely holding on, to the roof. And a helicopter came, sent down a rope ladder, told him, in the loudspeaker, told him, "Take hold of the rope ladder." Says, "I'm here to save you." Says, no, "God's going to save me." The helicopter flew away, and the person drowned. And as his spirit came to the other world, and he met God, he complained, says, "God, where were you? I trusted in you. I prayed to you." He says, "What do you mean? I sent you two boats and a helicopter." So it's important, there's a God, but we have to act as well. We have to act with prudence. And sometimes we get desperate, and we act without prudence. And really, and that's the V of the half faith, which I call voodoo. Very often, because we become desperate, we do all kinds of desperate things. I was just hearing they stopped running these ads, but on WWJ, this is one of the. They were speaking on the about enlisting psychics, for all your problems, or you go to astrologists for all your problems, or for this for all your problems. You have to daven. You have to have intimate relationship with God, and you have to do what's prudent. It reminds me of a song from the 60s. I won't go into all details, but there's a cute line in the song, and it was called "The Bomb." And it started off that first we got the bomb, but that's But that's good because we stand for love and motherhood. You know? And then Russia got the bomb, but that's okay. The power, the balance of power is maintained that way. And it goes, who's next? You know, then France got the bomb, but needn't grieve. They're our allies, I believe. And then Egypt's gonna get one too. This was the time when the East German scientists were in Egypt. Just to use on you, know who. So Israel's getting tense, gonna get one in self-defense. The Lord's our shepherd, that's our psalm, but just in case, better get a bomb. But that's how Jews act. We have faith, but we get the bomb. That's the A of act. Just to end this section of have, just briefly, with the E of excuses. Very often fears are not really fears at all. They're just excuses. We're just lazy to do. So instead of actually doing what's prudent, and this is, we quote from Proverbs here, you can see, that the lazy man says, there's a lion in the way, a lion's in the street, you know, it's dangerous going out. The fears are manufactured. Ultimately, the underlying is really basically a person's fear of failure. He's lazy. He doesn't want to do. And it's important from the Jewish and from the Torah's viewpoint to realize, you know, life is short. We have a mission to accomplish. We can't afford to waste our time just sitting and doing nothing. And I'm reminded of a beautiful story. And this story has meaning on many different levels. One of the great rabbis in pre-World War II Europe was a person called Yisroel Meir Kagan. Yisroel Meir HaKoyen, known as his pen name, the Chofetz Chaim. It was named after the first of his many works. In his time, he was very famous. The story is told, I met the family of this man. It was a man who came from the old country, from Eastern Europe, settled in Chicago, and in his later years wanted to go back to his ancestral home, to the old country, to see his remaining relatives. And he'd heard about the Chofetz Chaim, just wanted to see him. His fame was all over Europe and America. And he came to his home. It was a small town in Poland, not far from Vilna, called Radom. And he was shocked by the poverty of the Chofetz Chaim. He'd never seen such poverty, maybe. I mean, a man of such prestige. I mean, he had no furniture. He had tables and chairs, but no furniture. And in the midst of the conversation, he couldn't hold himself back. And he blurted out the Chofetz Chaim. He says, Rebbe, where's our mebel? He says, Rabbi, where's your furniture? And the Chofetz Chaim didn't respond immediately. But further in the conversation, he stopped the conversation and asked his visitor, oh, by the way, I forgot to ask you. He says, Avu is our mebel. Where's your furniture? He says, Rebbe, mebel, my furniture. Chobnot Svetche Chimadanas, and I am just going with two suitcases. I'm just going through. I'm just passing through. He says, I too, the Chofetz Chaim says, I'm just passing through. In life, we're just passing through. If your view says that life is short and we're just passing through, you have to get a sense of urgency. It's one phase of existence. As we said before, like one of the, it's obvious, it's part of Jewish tradition. And I believe says that there's much support for this belief outside of just tradition. We believe there's another phase of our existence beyond this life. We're here for a mission. It's important to concentrate. We have great things to do, and not to be hung up on the fact is, you know, it's no use. I'm a failure anyway. Whatever you can do, do. You know, there's a great story. I'll just stop from the, also from the Chofetz Chaim told. There's a beautiful story associated with him. Again, it touches upon this and touches upon many areas of life. there was a certain rabbi, a certain rabbi of a town that wanted to leave his congregation and retire and to go to what was then Palestine, Eretz Yisrael, to Israel. And Chofetz Chaim asked him, why do you want to? I mean, he still was vibrant. I mean, why do you want to leave? He says, I'm ineffectual. It was a very difficult period. Many people were leaving Judaism. I feel really a failure. So Chofetz Chaim, let me tell you a story. There was a village in Russia or Poland that was actually owned by a Polish count, the Poritz. And the count made a visit to this village. Of course, he was greeted by the mayor of the village, who brought him to his home and served him tea. And the count drank the tea. It was very bitter, and he spit it out and says, why is it so bitter? So the mayor of the village explained to him that they have two sources of water in that village. There is a stream that goes really right through the village, and there's a spring of fresh water that's 2 miles away. It's very hard to go 2 miles to get fresh water. The stream was made of brackish water, but that's the closest thing, and that's what they use, and they use it for drinking as well. Indignantly, the count told the mayor, from now on, everyone in the village is required to only use spring water. They cannot use the water from that stream. Sometime later, a fire broke out in the village. Decimated, burned the whole village down to the ground. And the count again, this was his property, came to visit the village and spoke to the mayor. And he says, usually there's a fire brigade. There's a bucket brigade. At least something is saved. He says, what happened? Well, you told us not to use the water of the stream. So by the time we get to the spring and back, says the town had burned down. He says, I told you about drinking water. When there's a fire burning, you throw anything at it. And the Chofetz Chaim continued, today there's a fire burning. You can't say, well, I don't have the ability. You throw everything at it. You do whatever you can. And it's a message for those who want to affect the community. It's a message for us in life. We can only do what we can do. But we have to do the best with what we have and not make excuses. So again, the first part is have faith. The have is hope, but it has to be coupled with act. It has to be done prudently, and that's the matter of voodoo. Don't run for all kinds of things. Act prudently and pray. And E is many of our fears are just excuses. The faith. The first, the F of faith, as we call fate. The view, it couples with the idea of hope. Everything in our life is part of this is our belief. It's part of a fate. That before we were born, there's a fate. There's a fate that comes every Rosh Hashanah when we're judged. But every part of our life is in God's hands. What's not in God's hands is really from, this is the quote I have, if you have your handout on page 3, is what's not in God's hands is our religious response to life. Hakol bidei shamayim chutz miyirushim. Everything's in God's hands except the fear of God. How religiously we will act, he gives us free will. How much money we're going to make this year, or ultimately how our life is going to, that's in God's hands. What we're going to do with our lives, that's in our hands. Right? There's an interesting Agadata, there's a story from the Gemara, Nida and Tezayin Amud Beis in 16b, where it says, this is in the style of the Agadata, as soon at conception,
the embryo, figuratively, is brought before God's throne. And the question is asked to God, what's going to be with this child, this future child? Is it going to be wealthy or not? Is it going to be wise or not? There's several questions that are asked. One question that is not asked is, will this person be saintly? Will he be righteous? That's in a person's own hands. You know, they say the story, again, and this is I just quote from the Chofetz Chaim because he had a wealth of wisdom. And this same story is told by many other great people. You know, very often the Chofetz Chaim says, we worry about how we're going to make our livelihood, what's going to happen, about what's going to happen to us religiously, spiritually. We don't worry. God will take care of it. And the truth is, it's just the opposite. It says, God will take care of our livelihood and our health. We have to take care of our saintliness. So that's the F of faith, is faith, this realization that what happens to us, we're in His hands. However, there's one part which, again, which also parallels the A of act to the A of afflictions. And again, we quote here from the Gemara in Ksuvos. It says that everything is in God's hands, says, except cold and heat, and is basically being careless with our health. And is going out in the cold where we should have been careful, or being exposed ourselves to heat where we could have been careful. There's areas that are left up to us. We have to take care of that. Otherwise, what we can't take care of, there's no fear. We're in God's hands. And that's the A. The I, which just shows that fascinating thing, is intuition. Very often, we may be gripped by an irrational fear. It comes as all of a sudden. Sometimes, it's what we're really having is a premonition. There's a notion which is stated in the Talmud, which we find a parallel idea. There's a fascinating book. If you haven't read this, I think it's really worthwhile. It's a book called Many Lives, Many Masters by Dr. Brian Weiss, who at the time that he wrote this book was a chief of psychiatry in Mount Sinai Hospital in Miami. And he had a case of a woman that would not respond to normal therapy and use hypnosis, regression therapy, to go back to this, to the root cause of her many phobias. And she discussed life in Greece 3,000 years ago. And this is the theme of the Many Lives, Many Masters, about she describes her various incarnations. But one interesting theme also she describes is the notion that we have basically masters, like guardian angels, that guide us. Sometimes when we have fear, it's really, we shouldn't dismiss it. Maybe there is something here. If it doesn't, your normal fear that you have, it isn't the regular fear that grips you in a... but there's a sense of something is wrong. We should listen to that. So it could perhaps be an inner voice. The T of faith, you have on page 4, he calls Torah. There's an area, again, that we should have fear of. Regular fear, that's really, this, as we said, the essence of Judaism, one of the pillars of Judaism, is that sense of we're in God's hands. But the area that is not in God's hands, again, is our own spiritual development. And the T of Torah, if you read the citation, is what should a person be afraid of when it comes to Torah? Remembering the Torah that he studied, the Torah that he was negligent in studying, that goes in part of the spirituality that's in our free will, and that rightfully we should be afraid of. Everything else, we're in good hands. That we have to take in our own, we have to exert our own initiative. And finally, the H of have faith. as we call it, says help. We've discussed about praying, about the importance of our own praying. There's place, though, to have others help us, to have others pray on our behalf in addition to our own faith. I don't know if you've noticed in the synagogue, very often names are given. So besides the importance of our own prayer, which basically prayer is a statement, we're articulating our belief, our life is in your hands, God. But there is a place for communal prayer. And I'd like to quote to you, this is from page 227 of the book Healing Beyond the Body by Dr. Larry Dossey. And I quote, "The most celebrated 20th century prayer study involving humans was published in 1988 by physician Randolph Bird, a staff cardiologist at UC San Francisco School of Medicine. Bird randomized 393 patients in the coronary care unit, the San Francisco General Hospital, either to a group receiving intercession, or to a control group. Intercessory prayer was offered by groups outside the hospital. In other words, there were two groups. One was saying, this group they're going to be prayed for. The other group are not going to be prayed for. The patients were not aware of who was being prayed for, nor their attending physicians were aware of who they're being prayed for. The people were not instructed how often to pray, but only to pray as they saw fit for the people that were there supposed to pray for. In this double-blind study, in which neither the patients, physicians, nor nurses knew who was receiving prayer, the prayed-for patients did better on several counts. There were fewer deaths in the prayer book, in the prayer group. They were less likely to receive endotracheal intubation and ventilator support. They required fewer potent drugs, including diuretics and antibiotics. They experienced a lower incidence of pulmonary edema. They required cardiopulmonary resuscitation less often," end quote. In other words, evidently, it says, God wants us not only to pray for ourselves, but to pray for others as well. He listens to those prayers. Again, I'd just like to briefly summarize everything that I've said, and I want to end off with a story. We started off just analyzing fear, about the various schools, how to deal with fear, specifically this irrational fear, and the school of psychotherapy, which has helped many people, the school of behavior modification, which has also helped many people, and what we were offering tonight with the idea of a whole change in outlook, the one that's of lives with God. There's a story that's told of someone who visited the Grand Canyon. He was on a tour. And at a certain point of the canyon, the person was fixated. It was just an amazing view. And he told the rest of the group to go on. He would join the rest of the group. And he just stood there mesmerized, looking down at the canyon floor, and as he was getting closer to the edge to get a good look, he lost his footing and fell. And his fall was stopped by a tree that grew on the side of the canyon, some 15 feet from the ledge. And as he gained his composure and realized he was in real trouble, started crying for help, top of his lungs. But unfortunately, the group that he had come with had already left and was beyond earshot. And the next group was expected in an hour. Realizing that he wasn't likely to hold on for an hour, he thought about maybe he could climb to the top. But he realized it's a sheer climb. He would never make it. Then he thought. He looked down. It was a mile down. He looked down, he looked up, and he started praying like he never prayed in his life. And I'll be good and just listen to my prayers and all kinds of commitments and all kinds of pleas. And finally, he says, a voice came from heaven. He says, I'm God. I'm here to help you. It's good, good. He says, do you really trust him? Oh, yeah, I really trust in you, God. Just get me out of here. He says, if you really trust in me, I want you to show me you really have faith in me. What do you want me to do? I want you to let go. Let go? Yeah, I want you to just let go, and I'll take care of you. You're in good hands. And he looked down. It's a mile down. He looked up. There was no way he'd make it to the top. And then his head went up. He says, hey, is there anybody else up there who could help me? Very often in life, we're always looking for that someone else. The key, though, to basically, I believe, is a relatively happy and worry-free existence is really to that sense that we are in good hands. We can let go. We have to be prudent. We have to act responsibly. But basically, really, there's really nothing to worry about. Now, are there any questions? Must be good. No questions? Okay. What, you have a question? Oh, fine.
If, as you say, there's two, part of the faith is in your hands and your future is in the hands of God, it's already preset. But the part that's in your hands, how you treat that, doesn't that also affect the other part?
Yeah, the question is a very, very well taken. What is the balance, basically? This is the, well, if everything is predestined and yet there is something in our hands, right? And we do. Are we affecting the predestination, so to speak, through our actions? Like, what happens? It just, there's a certain fluidity of life. And what happens to us very often is really what we experience in life. Is very dependent on where we're basically holding in life at any one point. It would be the equivalent of, just give one, we give an example, of a toddler who's beginning to walk. Well, if the toddler takes certain steps this way, you grab him, he can fall into a manhole. If he takes certain steps that way, it's good, it's good, he's doing good. We're on top of him, but basically our response is based sort of what steps that toddler takes. I'm just giving as an example. Very often, because of the decisions that we make, there are changes in our life. For instance, I said it's possible for a person to commit suicide, or short of suicide, to act irresponsibly. Well, a person may not have been fated, so to speak, to undergo some terrible experience, but if you tempt fate, if you put yourself if you just close your eyes and just walk across the highway, say that God will take care of me, probably that decision that you made will change the rest of your life if it lasts. So there are decisions that we make. But ultimately, God's there. And there have been decisions that have been made even before we were born, as we said. We quoted from the passage in the Talmud. Our intelligence. What kind of parents we're going to have or had. Because we're born in certain families and in certain areas, what kind of friends we're going to have. There's certain hosts of experience that have been predestined. But within that predestination, there's still the room for us to make decisions. And those decisions, again, will alter. This is what will proceed. I'm just reminded my children, when they were growing up, had these books at home. I don't know if you've read them. You know, if you make this decision, if you decide to walk through the door, turns to page 38. if you decide like to stay still, turn to page 43. You know, that based on our decisions, again, whole things open up to us. We have to act prudently. We have to pray, which basically is stating that we put our lives in God's hands, and we have nothing to worry about. Okay, you should have a wonderful night, and hope to see you next month. Be well.